This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Film Pasture Podcast. The Film Pasture is the sister side podcast to the Lambcast, which can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. I am one of your hosts, The Vern, and for the next hour or so, I'm going to be playing you yet another sampler plate of really great podcast shows that you should definitely check out. If you like the clips we play, I'm hoping you will go on to that particular podcast site or whatever they stream on and listen to the full episode and download their other episodes, and we'll be a big, happy podcast community. But I'm not going to dabble on it anymore because you don't want to hear my voice. You want to hear the clips I'm going to play. So moving on to our first clip. This comes to us from the Original Remake Podcast. And on this particular episode, host Peter and special guest Chris Bratton of the podcast More Gooder Than are comparing both Spider-Man, directed by Sam Raimi, and it had Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst, with The Amazing Spider-Man, directed by Mark Webb, and it had Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. And in this section, Peter and Chris are comparing both Peter Parkers, you know, the pros and cons of both Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. So let's go ahead and listen to see what they say, okay? We'll do that, all right?
Let's start with the character of Peter Parker, because they are both kind of played differently by Tobey Maguire and also Andrew Garfield. In the first one, the 2002 version, In that one, he really does kind of play it like a geek in the film. He is very painted as this, dork. You know, he's a loser. Kids are laughing at him as he is, chasing after the bus almost every morning, it seems like, for a really long time. And it's kind of crazy too, because he does have this friendship with Harry Osborn, who I might have missed how long they've actually been friends, but Norman comes from money. His father is very powerful. It's like, why is he hanging out with a loser and goes to what is seemingly just a regular, like, public school?
Well, he gets kicked out of everything, right? That's his whole thing. Yeah, he gets kicked out of every, like, private school. And so he has to just, this is like his last one that he can go to. And Peter, for some reason, is just the one that Peter was nice to him. I mean, that's really what it was. Okay. Peter was nice. Yeah. I know. Was this the first time most people saw James Franco? I think it was.
It was for me, for sure.
Yeah, I think it was for me, too. I think, yeah. And I mean, I liked him. I thought he did a good job. So I've never been a huge fan. But yeah, this Spider-Man definitely, I think, matches up more with what the comics want him to be. They want him to be a geeky, a science geek that doesn't really fit in, because they want him, because that's the appeal of Spider-Man for most people, is that he's not cool. You know, like Bruce Wayne is super cool. You know, Wolverine is super cool. You know, like none of these guys ever get, they don't have to deal with normal problems. You know, they're just the cool loner guy. This is a guy that values his friendships because they're important to him, you know, and he doesn't, his life doesn't go well for him. You know, like he could be doing all these amazing things as Spider-Man, but his actual like home life is always a wreck because he's just some nerd. So, that's the biggest difference, I think, between the two, because in Amazing Spider-Man, he's more of just an outcast, which is a different way to say it. I know that that's not a, cause there's geek where he, there's the geek where he's tormented, which I think, like, he has bullies. And then in the Andrew Garfield one, it's just like, he's just a loner that doesn't, this can sound mean, he doesn't literally like want friends. You know, he just wants to skateboard wherever. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I know that's he's not as likable. like Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, very likable guy. You know, like you want to root for him. Andrew Garfield, I didn't really want to root for him. Like he's not someone that I think people, there's some people that are rooting for him, but not like you would for Tobey Maguire, right? Would you agree?
Right. Yeah, no, I do agree. And they both do, like photography for the school as well, but it seems as though like the Tobey Maguire one is a little bit more, it's kind of known, and I guess, he's more actively taking pictures, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Garfield, it's like he's sneaking pictures, and the only time anyone really asks him to take a picture is like when, Flash was like picking on some other kid.
Oh, right.
You know, he's like, get a picture of this.
Freaking
like,
Flash Gordon,
in the beginning.
Right? Freaking Flash
Yeah,
Gordon.
Right. So we got two Flashes, both in the same movie, but two different girls.
Yeah. No, because you're getting, well, because that's the original, you know, as you know, I mean, the original love was Gwen Stacy, and that's what, so
right.
I do like actually that they do that for, that's what I think Amazing Spider-Man does right. Is that it does start with Gwen Stacy. So, which is
right.
Where it should. I am just so, I love superhero movies so much. And the original Spider-Man needed to do an origin story. Like it did, because it was the first real superhero movie. Like hats off to
right.
Original Spider-Man. It started to show people that you could really do quality films as a superhero. Movie. It really, I mean, like all of the superhero movies now really owe a lot to that movie for sure. And then I just think where they went wrong with Amazing Spider-Man is like, why do you need another origin story? You just don't need it. Do like a 10-minute flashback every so, like do 10 minutes total in film. No one needs to know that he got bit by a spider. Just go in. Everybody knows who Spider-Man is. Like everyone does.
Yeah. So you're thinking that maybe this should already start off and he's already got the powers.
Just go into it. And if you need to, for some reason, reference, everyone knows Uncle Ben dies. Everybody knows Uncle Ben dies. Everyone knows he lives with Aunt May. Everyone, like, that's how they did it in Civil War. It's just like, this is Spider-Man, that's Aunt May. You don't need to talk about Uncle Ben dying. You don't need to talk about he got bit by a spider. You don't need to do all this. Just launch into it. Everybody and their mother knows who's, if I ask my mom, who does not care about superhero movies, hey mom, how did Spider-Man get his powers? Oh, he got bit by a spider, right? And his uncle died. She would know too. I can ask my grandma.
And his uncle died.
His uncle dies. His uncle dies and, yeah, anyway. I don't know.
Probably going to be like, his uncle was played by Martin Sheen, right? I love Martin Sheen.
Right. I get sick of origin stories for some of these incredibly popular characters. The only one that I was actually fine with in terms of origin stories was when they did it in Man of Steel, where they showed all the Krypton stuff before Superman left. I know I'm going on Superman tangent, but you needed that one to set up Zod, you know, which was the important thing. You didn't need to, but
right.
Anyway, I get sick of origin stories. They take up so much space when you could be doing something else.
And not only was the Amazing Spider-Man, included in origin story, it almost really felt like Mark Webb kind of like rewatched the Sam Raimi version and started creating like a checklist. All right, I'm going to do that better.
Right.
I'm going to do that better.
Right.
You
oh
know,
my gosh,
because
you're so right.
Because what I do like about The Amazing Spider-Man is the relationship between Peter and Uncle Ben.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's more of a dynamic there.
Right.
You get some real tension.
Yes.
And I feel like your heart breaks even more
mm-hmm.
for Peter when Uncle Ben dies, because that's a, you know, very much like the first one. It's he's the fault of everything. I feel The Amazing Spider-Man, he's the fault for everything.
Right.
That happens, you know, everything bad that happens to him. You know, you can even put the blame on the death of Captain Stacy on him as well. So that's where it's kind of different. Like, Andrew Garfield's Peter Parker, he's more of, I feel, I don't know, they're both kind of assholes, to be honest with you, in both versions.
That's funny.
That was from the original Remake podcast, and if you want to hear that full episode, you can search for them on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbean, I know if you go onto Twitter, they are at Original Remake, and you can search for episodes on there. But yeah, that's for it for the Original Remake podcast. I definitely recommend checking out their other episodes, okay? Our next show comes to us from the Mad, Bad, and Downright Strange podcast, aka MBDS. And on this episode, host Elwood Jones was hosting a Deadpool. No, he wasn't doing a show about the movie Deadpool. He wanted his guests to pick out the best death scenes in movies. And joining him were Kim Lowe, his co-host for Game Warp, Daniel Lackey, his co-host for TV Good, Sleep Bad, and maybe a newcomer to the show, but I don't believe he is. Great, and I'm going to pronounce his last name wrong, Sudachi. He's from the Debatable podcast. And they each list their favorite death scenes. And then Kim Lowe makes a, she basically makes an honest opinion about a beloved classic, The Godfather. And it leads into a different sort of discussion about being fans or not being a fan of a movie that everyone else loves. So let's go ahead and just have a small listen now to that session, and you'll see more of me, right? Let's go ahead and have a listen.
Kim, you got anything you want to talk about Godfather 2? Or
other than the confession that I haven't actually seen Godfather 2.
That's okay.
Have you seen the first one?
I'm going to make a really, really, like, people are going to hate me after this. Like, me and my husband, like, my husband loves The Godfather. And I just can't get into it. I don't know. Every time I watch it, I sleep. I just, it's automatic. I just fall asleep.
It's so understandable.
You know, like, the second one, I've only seen a few scenes. I remember, was it that one where they brought that carpet into the building, into the home or something? That's the one I remember. And then after that's a scene my husband likes to imitate a lot. And then, it's just blank after that. I don't remember anything.
Go ahead, Dan.
But do you like The Money Pit?
I haven't seen The Money Pit.
Okay.
But like I said, I have a lot of movies that is on my list. People are like, you have to go see this. And I'm like, oh, I haven't seen it yet.
There's about three people in the entire world that will get that joke, and apparently none of them are on this podcast.
No. I've been in a few relationships where the person that I was with, you know, it's a difficult thing to take that person on a journey when you're an old movie weirdo like I am. And I didn't always have the attention span for it, especially, you know, the age that I am, where the time period that I grew up in, we were, you know, used to MTV style editing. We were into faster paced storytelling. So when you try to turn someone on to older movies, whether it is 30s, 40s cinema or 70s cinema or whatever, the pacing is just different, you know, and it's something that I always tell people, if you're interested in going down that road, or you have a partner who's really into those movies and you kind of want to go on that journey with them, you know, don't feel like you're disappointing upsetting the habitat by, you know, not being into it. You have to be on the wavelength for it. And you could, you know, the way that I kind of grew my attention span was giving it a chance. There are movies that put me straight to sleep, you know, just the pacing of it, the heavy dialogue scenes, melodrama. It's very hard to get into, but, you know, it's about exposing yourself to it in spurts. And then eventually maybe you start digging on esoterica, or you dig on kind of a different pacing than we're used to. It's very hard to break yourself of that when we're so used to that in everything, in TV, commercials, everything that we watch.
Yeah, it's with The Godfather, it's a very different pace. I think a lot of people, they come in, they watch like Scorsese's gangster films, so it's like Casino and Goodfellas, and those are very fast paced and a very visceral films. And then when they feel that, oh, I watched Coppola's Godfather, because, you know, that's another mobster film. And with Coppola's film, it's more about what they're saying than what they're doing. Yes, it has these visual moments in it, but it's a film more driven by its dialogue and its character actions than anything as visual. But to judge Coppola's back catalogue just on The Godfather, I think, is a bit of a misstep, as you can look at The Godfather and then you look at Apocalypse Now, and those are two very different films. So if you don't like The Godfather, then don't put it, use it as a way to put yourself off seeing what else Coppola has done, as he certainly, he truly is one of those master directors whose work is worth exploring, even if you don't like The Godfather. And I think it's been, people are now more braver now than they used to be to say, you know, I don't like The Godfather. It used to be like this cardinal sin, and that people are like, oh, how can you not like The Godfather? But, you know, there's a lot of movies out there. You can't like everything.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the thing is, I feel that generally I'm not a big fan of gangster mob movies. And that's a general thing. Like, I'm not drawn to them.
No.
And I have that same issue with, like, say, Scorsese, the Gangs of New York, which I thought was decent. I like that one. That was all right. I don't remember a lot of it anymore, but I do remember it was all right. Mm-hmm. And then there's, like, that American Gangster with Denzel.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was just absolute ugh. I hated that one so much. I went to the theaters to see that. Me and my best friend sat there. We were like, what is going on? When is this going to end? You know? So I categorize myself into, like, I'm not a big gangster mob person.
Right.
But then, you know, you jump into something like Hong Kong triads sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I'm into that. So I don't know. Maybe it's different pacing, I guess. And it's the fact that, like, I watch a lot of these when they're 90s, and the pacing of 70s movies and 90s movies are different.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And plus, I mean, like, Italian mob stuff has been done to death by this point, you know? That's why it's hard to get into The Sopranos. A lot of people had a certain expectation of The Sopranos that it was going to be a death of the week type show. They watched it for that instead of the content, you know, the context of it. So I think that show, for instance, is kind of going against expectation of the quote unquote Italian La Cosa Nostra mafia type thing that is kind of ubiquitous in our American entertainment. Whereas, you know, Yakuza movies and triad movies are, you know, there's something fresh there, especially if it's, you know, not something you see very often. I mean, I used to love watching Kitano Yakuza movies for that, because it felt, you know, so fresh, not something you see every day, and he did it so in a new way.
Cool.
I would like to close this out by saying the best way to acclimate yourself, in my opinion, to slower paced films is to basically get yourself a copy of Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky and make yourself watch it. And once you've sat through that, and I'm saying this as somebody who loves slower paced films in which nothing happens. Once you've sat through Stalker, you can sit through anything.
I like it.
Thanks for that, Lucky. I've still got that to watch this week.
All right.
It's like on the box. It's like, oh, I'm going to really watch Stalker. And
So that was from the Mad, Bad, and Downright Strange podcast. You can send all your letters of disappointment to Kim over at Tranquil Dreams, but no, don't. She's actually a very sweet lady. You know, I wouldn't recommend that at all. But yeah, you can find more about the Mad, Bad, and Down and Strange podcast through iTunes, through Podbean, through Stitcher Radio. I said iTunes before. They don't really have a website for them. I know you can follow each of the host things on Twitter, and I don't know their exact names offhand here. But if you just type in MBDS podcast, you should be able to find that full episode on a whole bunch of other podcast listening sites. I do recommend checking out that as well as other episodes, right? So moving on, third one on the list is from the First Time Watchers podcast. This show is hosted by Tim Costa, Hermano Del Sava, and Walter Vinci. And these cats, they review films they have never seen before, and these get together and talk about it. And for this particular section, they are looking back at some of the underrated movies that Christopher Nolan directed. So they're talking about the movies Following, The Prestige, and Insomnia, which made sense because Dunkirk just opened in theaters, so they're going to spend some time just talking about these lesser-known films, all right? So let's go ahead and listen to these cats talk about these movies, all right?
Moving on. In this episode, we'll be discussing the much-anticipated and highly lauded Christopher Nolan film Dunkirk, but before we get into that, it is time for Yay or Nay.
Yay!
This is the part of the show where we discuss what we have seen recently on our own. Mark?
Recently, I've watched some Christopher Nolan films. So is it okay if I talk about a couple of those?
Of course.
Briefly? I was inspired by, I kind of came to these a little bit late thinking, yeah, I need to catch up on a couple. One especially that you recently caught up with that I've only seen since it came out. But first one I wanted to mention is the aforementioned by Hermano, The Following. That is, it's his first film in black and white, actually shot in 16 millimeter. And it happens to be the only film on Criterion, only one in the Criterion collection.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's well worth checking out. It's, I would say for any other director, frankly, I think it would be an extra on a disc, like another film released by Criterion. But my sense is that's the only one they could get the rights to.
Yeah.
So, you know, they released it. And it's worthwhile. There's some really nice supplements on it. I don't know how much. I think Nolan has done some commentaries on other discs, and he does on this one. And there's a nice probably 20 to 30 minute interview kind of about his beginnings, which is cool. Like, you know, he reveals that he never went to film school. He was self-taught, you know, and since he was young, he always had a camera. I mean, how many directors have said that?
He never went to film school. This might answer some questions I have with his editing techniques.
It is worth seeing. I think you kind of get a look into him. I mean, he's definitely a good filmmaker. The acting is certainly wanting, and I mean, it's a nice neo-noir. I think it really feeds well into Memento, and it has a nice naughty end, and it plays with time. So his very first film is another one that is told kind of linear. It's linear for the first third, and then from there on out it's not linear, if I remember correctly. And so yeah, I mean, you certainly see some of the early workings of Nolan. So I definitely give it a yay. I've enjoyed it every time I've seen it, even with the, you know, the kind of the early filmmaking style that it is, amateur style. And the other one I watched was The Prestige. Again, this is the one I hadn't seen since it came out, and I own all his other movies, and this was really the last one that I felt like I needed to buy. So I picked it up. And I don't know, I guess I'd probably still put this in the middle of the pack, maybe even lower for his films. I think some people really enjoy this one a lot. I'm with Hermano, I think, in your discussion about this, how the whole reveal that you guys were talking about, I think you are meant to see it coming.
No, that's me. Sorry. Yeah, we both kind of said the same thing. Yeah.
Okay, you did. Yeah. So yeah, and I just think it's him really, he's showing the audience, you know, you're meant to see that something is wrong, and you know, maybe the entire film was a magic trick. I don't think he really quite pulls that off, but I think it really gets to that line early on that Cutter says that, you know, you don't really want to find the answer, you want to be fooled. So you know, to me it's all of that, and you know, it seems kind of obvious to me. I do like how I still felt the emotion of the end and how things come together and some of the decisions that they had made. So I was overall positive on it. Again, I give it a yay. I do feel that the female characters again are wasted. I think it's unfortunate that I didn't really consider some of his other films, but I think, you know, Nolan seems to really enjoy directing male actors the most. So, you know, but still, yay. I mean, like you said, Hermano, I don't think he's made a bad film. It's just varying degrees of how much I liked a particular film. So, and lastly, just on Nolan, maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, but I keep coming back to him. You know, as we mentioned, he's self-taught, never went to film school, and I think he is a lot like who I probably still say is my favorite director, Stanley Kubrick, in that, you know, he'll try his hand at multiple genres. He doesn't make sequels like Kubrick, except for the ones that, of course, you know, had to have because they were comic based. And you know, some of his working with actors, his methods, I don't know about Nolan's methods. I don't know how well he really works with actors, but it kind of stands out sometimes. Some of the emotion, I think, is missing from his films, maybe like Kubrick. So
I completely agree with that. I don't find him to be an actor's director at all. He's a very technical technical director, you know, and it's just funny comparing him to other you know, highly lauded, highly praised directors. You know, you think Paul Thomas Anderson, I mean, he coaxes performances out of everybody, you know? And you even David Fincher, I think, gets much better performances in his films than Nolan does overall.
Overall. I mean, there's some moments and, you know, some films work better than others. And I'll be curious to see what you think about that kind of thread in Dunkirk.
Anything else for you? Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Well, continuing on Christopher Nolan, actually, I did catch up with Insomnia from 2002. Now, this is a movie that I saw in the theater, but I hadn't seen since then. And this is the one with Al Pacino and Robin Williams and Hilary Swank. Two Los Angeles homicide detectives are dispatched to a northern town where the sun doesn't set to investigate the methodical murder of a local teen. You know, this is one where... I would put this on the lower part of Nolan's filmography because it's a very straightforward film. There's nothing tricky about it. You know, there's nothing really different. It doesn't really stand out much from many other procedurals. You know, I would even say, you know, when you talk about female leads in his films, Hilary Swank is not much of a character. In this, it doesn't really stand out, and it just seemed maybe that his heart wasn't into this movie, you know, because there's nothing that really stands out from this film overall. It's really I think something that I know is a chink in his armor when it comes to his overall filmography. It's just kind of sad to see something that you know where I've lauded Nolan's technical you know precision in his films, but there's nothing in this film. You know, I don't really have much to say about it. I'm kind of struggling even just to talk about it because it's a rather unmemorable film. So I don't know.
It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
It probably is my least favorite of his films. I didn't really like the end. I highly recommend the Criterion version of the original, though. It's much better, starring Stellan Skarsgård. I think some of the scenes, whether it's him or... See, I kind of think there's some studio interference because this is probably his first... I don't know if it's first studio, but, you know, first bigger budget film after Memento. And, you know, I think you see some of it, like, with the scene with the dog. It's much more visceral in the original. So recommend that.
All right. Fair enough.
All right. So that was from the First Time Watchers podcast. And you can definitely find that full episode as well as other episodes just by going to the site firsttimewatcher.blogspot.com. I believe that's just with the number one, sttimewatchers.blogspot.com. You can also find them on Twitter. They're at First Time Watchers with the number one, ST Time Watchers. You know the deal. But yeah, I'd recommend checking out their shows. They're a lot of fun. I love the banter that Tim, Hermano, and Walter have with each other. They definitely have the same type of fun banter as the guys from the Simplistic Reviews podcast do, as well as any other podcast, but that's one that comes to mind right now. But let's go ahead right now. And you know what? How about this? We are going to take a small little break right now. We're going to play some ads from some other really cool podcast shows. And then we'll be back to play our final two shows of the day, okay?
We'll return after these announcements.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it. Welcome back to the Film Pasture Podcast. We have our last two shows to play for you now. Our next one comes to us from the Ready Steady Cut Podcast. And for this particular section, Dan Hart and Jonathan Wilson basically look back at the elevator scene from Drive. All right, now they do go through the whole movie, and it's great. I love it. But I'm going to play you just the section where they talked about the elevator sequence. And if you've seen the movie Drive, you know about the elevator sequence. And if you've never seen Drive, then I can't help you out, because if you're a film fan, most likely you have at least seen Drive or know about the sequence, right? So let's let Jonathan and Dan talk about this awesome sequence in Drive, all right?
We'll go on to what I think is the main scene now, which strangely enough, and I'll tell you why it's... Sorry, strangely enough. And I'll tell you why it's strange in a minute. But the elevator scene is probably my favourite scene for the right and wrong reasons. But weirdly enough, this film, this scene in particular, was randomly inserted in. It was never meant to be in. Because he didn't know how to put in a scene where he was very romantic, but also a protector of the innocent at the same time. He just didn't know how to show two sides of him like that. And then as they started directing and doing more and more scenes, they got closer to the climax, they realised that, oh, wait a minute, let's do the elevator scene. I love this elevator scene. There's no dialogue. Yeah. It's, the kiss is out of his world. Like, I'm not in terms of, oh, it looks like a good kiss, but the way he does it, because he knows that this is probably the only time he's going to be able to kiss her before it starts kicking off. And I've never ever seen a scene that is so romantic, but so gruesome at the same time. Like, I've never seen the character, the way he shows two sides is...
What a travesty it would have been if they didn't include it.
I know. It's really weird. I can see where he's coming from, though, because he doesn't show a lot of romance throughout the film, so how do you then show him being a monster and a romantic at the same time? Very weird to do. But it's a standout scene. It's an incredible scene. Before I go on to something, I mean, what do you think of it?
Yeah, you're right. The fact that you said that he kisses her because it's the last time, it's probably the last chance he's going to get to do it. I think you're right about that. But I think the reason he thinks it's going to be the last time that he gets to do it is because he knows that what he's about to do will probably scare her off. And it's almost like he's sort of very aware of the fact that he does have this monster side to his character. And that if he's going to protect her, it's going to push her away at the same time. So he kind of sneaks the kiss. Also, what we're saying about holding shots, the kiss goes on for a long time, an unreasonable amount of time. And yet it always, it just feels, it works. You never think, okay, come on, like, you know, you're holding this shot for a bit too long. It seems like that moment feels really earned. Like, it's late in the movie. It's kind of the end, not end point, but like the high point of their relationship. They finally consummated it in some capacity. It's like a literalization of how they feel about each other. And then, again, you're right, no dialogue at all. The dialogue before that, though, is really impactful, where she slaps him. But the fact there's no dialogue in that scene, but yet again, you know exactly what's going on. You know that that guy is there to kill him. You know that he needs to protect her. It's all obvious. No dialogue at all, but all completely obvious all the way through. And the stomping is pretty horrific. I like the fact that it's filmed from below, like looking upwards at him.
Yeah.
And I actually like the fact that they cut to the guy on the floor one time, really briefly, just to get across the kind of horrificness of it. Because if you film it, if it was all filmed looking up and you could see Gosling stamping down, but you couldn't see the carnage underneath him, then yeah, it's not a very nice thing to see, but it's kind of abstract. You know, it's not real. Whereas just that real brief shot where it cuts to the guy on the ground and you can see how mangled he is.
Yeah.
It makes it a million times worse. And that's less than a second, that shot, I think. It's about half a second. You just see him on the ground. And it's just like, whoa.
For me, it wasn't the violence of it that made it for me. What made it for me was Irene's reaction. Her reaction confirms how violent this film gets. Because she is genuinely surprised by what he's just done. And he literally, you can hear the guy's head like squelch a little bit. And then it cuts to, like, Carey Mulligan's face. And her face is something of, like, you can kind of sense the horror she feels of what she's looking at. She's really confused how she could have feelings for someone who's just such a monster. And I had a strange realization when watching this film this week, because I don't know if you've seen The Great Gatsby.
Yes, I have. But
the bit where where Gatsby loses his shit in the hotel in Manhattan, or I think it's Manhattan. Sorry if I'm incorrect. And it's sweltering. And for the first time in the film, he shows like the monster side of him. And the way Carey Mulligan looks at him is exactly the same way that he looks at him in Drive, I think. And I think this is the reason why they cast her for Great Gatsby. Because they wanted someone who could do that reaction where it looks like they don't understand who they're looking at anymore. Like, who are you? Like, I was just kissing you a minute ago, and now you've just literally destroyed someone's head. And not many actors can do that. Well, I just loved you a minute ago, but now I just think you're a monster, and I just don't know. I'm so mixed in emotions.
Everything in one look.
Yeah, and her look in that makes it for me. I know Gosling does a lot of good looks in this, but that's one of probably the best looks in the film.
I love the fact that the door's closed on her as well. It's almost like, okay, like that's the door's closing on their relationship as well, to a certain extent. I don't think they see each other again after that scene. So doors are closed. I did wonder, okay, so where does Gosling get off the lift then? Because this is the bottom floor. But I didn't want to dwell on that too much because it sort of undermined it.
Don't pull out a plot hole. It's such a perfect film. So that's why I gave the film a 5. Right.
Yeah.
But
that was from the Ready Steady Cut podcast, where Dan and Jonathan talked about the elevator scene from Drive, the movie with Ryan Gosling, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. You know the deal. So that brings us to our final episode, which comes to us from the How Is This Movie Made? It's called How Is This Movie Podcast. And this is hosted by Dana Butler. And on each episode, he takes a look back at a movie, either good or bad, and kind of sets, hey, how did this movie come to be? You know, and it's really kind of fun, especially listening back to movies that you love or you hate, and you listen to him teach you about how this came to be. He had a guest on there named Phil. I'm going to pronounce the last name wrong. I apologize. Joanno, who is a filmmaker too. And they get to talk about how filmmakers who direct an independent feature suddenly move on to direct big budget movies. The thing that comes to mind the most is the guy who directed Looper and Brick. I think it's Rian Johnson. Now he's directing a Star Wars film. And guest Phil kind of breaks down why that is. All right. It's very fascinating. So let's go ahead and let's do that. All right.
Now, I want to touch on this subject a little bit more because I remember you and I had a pretty good discussion about this off air about a year ago.
I got to tell you, I'm so fed up at this point. I'm happy to talk about it.
Okay. So here's the thing. You've got Colin Trevorrow does a film called Safety Not Guaranteed. Then he gets Jurassic World, which does huge numbers. He's slated to possibly be the director of Star Wars Episode 9. You get Gareth Edwards, who does a film called Monsters. Then he gets Godzilla. Then he gets Rogue One, like we talked about. Rian Johnson does Looper, and now he's finishing up post-production on Star Wars Episode 8.
At least I really enjoyed Looper. To me, of all the ones you just described, from Looper to Episode 8 makes the most sense. Right? Because yeah. Looper, you see Looper and you say, wow, this guy's got control over it. He knows what he's doing. It was interesting. It was different. The way he, you know, the way he mixed, you know, the time, the space and time. Bruce Willis was great in it. I was like, wow, this guy's a good filmmaker. So to me, I see that leap. Go on.
Yeah, but the thing about Rian Johnson is, from what I understand, like he had some input in the script. Like, he wrote a story for Episode 8. So that's pretty surprising.
Yeah, he wrote a story. And again, but my assumption would be a story that had been already vetted through from the J.J. Abrams days. Meaning, it isn't like they went, go crazy, man, and we'll figure out the next one after you're done. You know, that was like, well, here's the things that need to happen. Here's what we've already talked about. Here's, again, like a television series. It's the second act. He's coming, assuming it's a trilogy, let's just say. It's a second act, and they're saying, okay, in the second act, these 12 things need to happen. Go ahead, take a run at it. But again, that's different than go write a Star Wars screen.
Okay, so I agree with everything you're saying. So I guess the question I have is, well, I mean, honestly, though, look, I've never been a director. But I feel like, you know, if I ended up on set of one of these films, I might even be able to direct it with the amount of control they've got on these films.
Dana, you could direct. I was actually thinking about doing, I mean, no one ever watched, but I joke around all the time that I was going to say, I was going to make a YouTube video, and it was going to be, anyone can direct a feature film. And I was going to use my 7-year-old son as an example. And I was just going to put him in a director's chair, and he was going to say, and action. And then we're going to wait a little while, and he's going to say, and cut. I say, there, he's a feature film director.
Okay.
Because it's true. And I was then going to go through point by point to prove you do not need, especially on these films we're talking about, you do not need a directorial skill set to direct them, period. I'm telling you, this is what I've done for my whole professional life, and the way it works now is I can do a quick breakdown for you. Basically, you understand these movies are pre-vised. And when you pre-vis a movie, the pre-vis tools are so sophisticated. And for those of you, I'm sure most people listening to this know what a pre-vis is, but it's an animatic, basically a little rough animation. But believe me, they're not very rough. They're incredible. The camera's moving and floating, and it's every cut. It's every effect sequence. They need to do these things so they understand, you know, what they're going to shoot live action, what's going to be CG, what's going to be a miniature, what's going to be a matte painting, what's going to be whatever the elements are, and they break it all down. They need the previs. They also need to know what kind of MoCo cameras they're going to use, what kind of equipment. Everyone breaks it down, not on storyboards. They might start with storyboards, but the previs is God. I mean, did you ever see the previs for The Kingsman, the giant fight sequence inside the church? Awesome, awesome. Yep. I loved it. Now, by the way, that took directorial skill. So this is not an example of painting by number. But the previs of that is the sequence in the movie. And they had to because it was so complicated. But I mean, every cut, every move, every camera wish pan, swish pan, all that looked all handheld and natural. They pre-vised it. So they got to see that whole complicated sequence before they shot a frame of film. And then it was done by two units, a first unit with the actors and a second unit with stuntmen. And that's how come it could be consistent, is because there was a previs. There were two directors finishing that sequence. Saw a whole thing of it. You can find it on YouTube. Yeah. It's pretty awesome. And it's really very informative. So now imagine that for an entire Jurassic Park movie. The whole thing's prevised. The movie has been pre-animated. Go ahead, look on YouTube for find previses from giant feature films. You'll go, what? It's the movie. You'll go, oh, yeah, it sure is. You get on the set. The director's job, the AD's job, that is to imitate the previs.
Yeah.
And you can't deviate, and this might also have been one of the problems, by the way, on the Han Solo movie. You can't deviate too far from some of that stuff because suddenly the effects explode in terms of time and money. Because suddenly you've got to do all this stuff you didn't plan for and all this other stuff you didn't plan for and all this stuff. Because you pan 5 feet left and you might be looking at a whole new planet. You're like, whoa, we didn't plan on showing that planet. We didn't budget that planet. Pan back. It's that meticulous. And so when you get out there, you're looking at the movie on a monitor pre-made or pre-vised. And so, sorry if I'm getting all worked up.
No, no, no. This is good. Please.
It's paint by freaking numbers. It's done in prep. And what's interesting about that is think about it for a minute. So it used to be you went out on the set. So Steven Spielberg walked out on the set of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and no one – he might have had storyboards. I know he did, but the point still was no one knew what he was really going to do, and he didn't have to stick to his storyboards. He could do it how he wanted to do it. So you look at that opening sequence in the desert, you know, in Mexico, and it's just like a tour de force of cinema by a guy in full control over every single aspect of movie making. Just watch that opening sequence. I tell people – just watch the opening scenes of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, turn it off, and that's modern, to me, modern cinema at its best. And I mean modern cinema. I mean right now, fresh and modern. Right. That's more modern now than 99% of the stuff being made today in terms of popular modern cinema. You know, I'm not talking art house. I'm not talking foreign films. I'm talking popular modern cinema where you go, wow. And by the way, and let alone the sequence that follows it in the air traffic controllers. And then go ahead and watch that. And that's a bunch of guys sitting in a chair looking at a screen. And that'll blow your mind. So none of that's previs, guys. None of that's previs. But nowadays, you go and you say, why does this movie seem so vanilla? Why does it seem so paint by number? Why does it seem so kind of prefabbed? Because it is prefabricated. And it allows, as I started out saying, it allows everybody to have an opinion before you shoot it. So now everyone can say, oh, I think it'd be cooler if we saw more of the T-Rex, or really that, or, you know, we should be wider there or closer there. This needs to be faster. We need more cuts in there. We should track more here and pull out there. People can have all kinds of opinions on the previs, and it's pretty easy to change. They put all the, quote, assets into the computer, and you pop it back out the next day. You've got a whole new sequence. So now you've got movie making and pre-production by, yes, committee to some degree. You get on the set, and all my seven-year-old needs to do is say action and cut. And because there's a whole host of seasoned professionals who have done these movies before who know what they're doing.
Now, it's interesting you bring up the pre-vis thing. I was doing a little research on pre-visualization about a week ago, and I came across the previs video for War of the Worlds that Steven Spielberg film that came out in 2005. And I have to say that that is one of the first Spielberg films that doesn't really feel like a Spielberg film. By that, I mean, it's exactly like you said, it seems very vanilla and a very CGI heavy effects movie. And I know Jurassic Park was a very CGI heavy effects movie, but it doesn't come across that way because they still had Stan Winston and they still used a lot of animatronics. But I want to go back to the most pressing question I have is, these movies are pre-visualized, they're prefabricated, as you say, so why are we hiring these indie film darlings? Why are these independent filmmakers being given these big, huge movies? The thought in my mind is, you know, people are already going to see the movie, and they don't have the name recognition. Well, some of them do now, but they don't have the name recognition going into that project. So why are they hiring them in the first place?
Listen, I can only guess because I've never had this conversation with anyone who does the hiring. But, and certainly they're not making a lot of public statements about this, but my guess is that, and it's kind of the assumption of many people that I know and work with, is that the newer, the more malleable, you know, the greener, the more controllable. Again, that's not fair to these guys as directors or human beings. I don't know any of them. I don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but I do know that you are talking about people who have maybe one or two films experience and nothing on the level that they're then, you know, hired to take on in these kind of gigantic tentpole universes. So, you know, I mean, I think that they see talent. I'm sure they have great meetings and I'm sure they get very excited. And I think they must like the people too, because it's a big collaborative effort. You gotta like, really, likability matters on these big giant machine movies. Like, you can't be a pain in the ass. You know, a pain in the ass is just not going to cut it. And let's face it, most, quote, visionaries are a pain in the ass. You know, everyone hears the stories about the guys. I mean, everyone knew Kubrick was a pain in the ass, right? I mean, that's like, you know, everyone knows Scorsese is demanding. Everyone knows Spielberg is demanding. Everyone knows De Palma was demanding. Like, if you have a vision, you're not going to take any shit. You're going to tell people to shut the fuck up and do what you want. And you usually are going to be pretty aggressive about it. And, you know, Ratu's supposed to be the same thing. You know, you hear about The Revenant. He's out there kicking people's asses. People were dropping like flies on that movie. He didn't care. He's going to get his movie. And it shows. And I think that – so you're not going to bring on an ass-kicking visionary to do these franchise movies. You want a collaborator. You want someone who's going to be open and malleable. You want to have someone who's going to be easy to work with, has enough experience. But, okay, so maybe they never did, you know, a full 3D CGI sequence, but that's okay because we've got Industrial Light and Magic, who Disney now owns, and they will pre-viz the crap out of it, and there you have it. It'll be done in advance. So we're not going to stumble over these sequences down the road. We'll have them before we shoot. And that creates, I think, a lot of confidence that you can get out there and they'll work with the actors.
All right. So that was from the How Is This Movie podcast. You can definitely search for them again on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher Radio. I know you can check out the show on Twitter. Just type in @H, How Is This Movie. They also have a Facebook page. In fact, all these shows I mentioned before, they have a Facebook page. You just gotta just type in the name itself there. And if you look on our Podomat page or on iTunes, I write down the names of each of the shows that's on here. So it's really easy for you to search for them in your search engine, okay? So, all right. So that's gonna wrap up this episode of the Film Pasture Podcast. Again, thank you very much for listening, everyone. As always, you can listen to our past episodes by searching for us on Podomatic, iTunes, Stitcher Radio. We are definitely featured on the LAM site, which again is largeassmovieblogs.com. Definitely check out the podcast and network section to hear about our show as well as other great podcast shows that are on that. Highly recommend it. I have to give a shout out to my co-host with the mostest, Kristen Lopez, who is currently in the hospital right now. I wish her a very speedy recovery. She had a bad accident. She hurt her legs, and I feel really bad. So I wish her all the best, and hopefully she'll be on an upcoming episode soon. Our next episode is all going to be about how to behave in theaters, theater etiquettes. And I have a few guests booked for that show, but I don't want to say who they are until they are actually on the show. Again, we are on Twitter @FilmPasture. We are also on Facebook. Just type in The Film Pasture. And I'm The Vern. You can find me on Twitter @VideoVanguard. And I will see y'all. Catch you later. Good night.